I'm Andrea Cabral. This is BPR Weekend. Afraid you missed something last week? Well, stay calm and carry on. We'll recap the week's top stories and look ahead to what's coming up. Noted criminal defense and civil liberties attorney Harvey Silverglate joins us with his take on James Comey's testimony, whether SCOTUS will grant a hearing on the Muslim ban, and if Donald Trump should be blocked from blocking Twitter followers.
I'm Marcela Garcia. How did a 26-year-old former Eagle Scout become the Jeff Bezos of the dark web? We'll talk to author Nick Bilton about his new book, American Kingpin, the epic fall of the criminal mastermind behind the Silk Road. All that and more on BPR Weekend on 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Good Sunday afternoon to you, and welcome to Boston Public Radio Weekend. We are broadcasting live from the GBH studios in the Boston Public Library. I am Andrea Cabral. I'm one of your two co-hosts for BPR Weekend. And let me introduce myself. Some of you may know me as the former Suffolk County Sheriff. Others may know me as the former Secretary of Public Safety under Governor Patrick. And you may have seen me on a few GBH programs like Greater Boston or Basic Black. And I'm a regular on Jim and Marjorie every Thursday for their Law and Order segment, although I mostly show up just to give Jim a hard time and make him miserable. My co-host and partner in crime on this, our inaugural show, is Marcela Garcia from The Globe. Hey, Marcela.
Hi, Andrea. I'm delighted to be here. A little bit about myself. I work for the Boston Globe. I'm an editorial writer, occasional columnist. I'm also a member of the editorial board. On a more personal note, I grew up in Mexico. I've been here 17 years, almost to the day, literally almost to the weekend. Next weekend is my anniversary in Boston, 17 years. I live in Brookline with my husband and my dog, whom I adore. Both of whom I adore, not just my dog.
But you stole from the dog this morning. You should tell them you stole from the dog.
Oh, man. I never typically eat breakfast, and my dog gets, among other things, a banana every morning, and I ate half of it. I stole from him.
He's deeply disappointed in you. You should know that. So you owe him. When you get back, it's got to be a banana and then something else.
Oh, my God. Trust me. He needs to lose weight, so that's why I kind of stole from him.
So listen, tell people a little bit about the show. Who are we? Who are we and why are we here?
So this is a pilot, right? This is a taste of Boston Public Radio, whom all of you are very familiar with, except on the weekend. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library. Today's a glorious day outside here in Copley Square. And the plan is to catch up on the news of the week past and look at the week coming up.
Right, and I think it's sort of an experiment like any other pilot, and it's live, so you can expect us to make a few mistakes, so you'll have to just bear with us on that.
Yes, please.
But we're going to have a lot of interesting guests, and we're going to have some surprises. We really just want to do, for you on a Sunday morning into afternoon, what BPR does for you during the week, which is to inform you and entertain you and provoke some thoughtful debate.
And definitely if you have suggestions, feedback, things that we should be covering, talking about, people from Boston that we should invite, definitely let us know. You can follow us on Twitter and email us. We'll be giving you all those details.
And we do. We have some folks that are actually here at the Newsfeed Cafe enjoying watching
Exciting.
The show and having their second or third cup of coffee. So our first guest, who we are thrilled to have, is a well-known First Amendment and civil liberties lawyer, Harvey Silverglate. But before we get to Harvey, we're going to talk about some of the news stories that are coming up. And Lord knows, Lordy actually is my new word. I should say that now.
Lordy
try to
knows.
Work that into every conversation. Lordy knows there's a lot of news happening. But not all of it is Trump-related, and I just was thinking this morning, as I was leaving the house, there was a series of news stories in quick succession, and they were as follows. A poor little girl in Mendon, Massachusetts, got bit by a black widow spider in Mendon, Massachusetts. Unfortunately, she's okay, but that was the first story that you figure that if it's a black widow spider, she's not here on vacation, there probably are others, right? So there's something to worry about. Then they followed that with a story about this huge mosquito problem we're going to have because the drought is over. So we just finished celebrating the drought is over. Well, there's nothing to celebrate because now there's going to be a mosquito population carrying all kinds of disease. And then, of course, we know ticks.
So nature is striking. And
right.
that is the thing That's that we should all be focusing on.
Right.
Except we are talking about all these other things, like this week.
Right.
All eyes in the world were focused on in the UK.
Right.
Right? Where they now have a hung parliament. And, you know, for us to explain exactly what that means, it's complex. It's a huge deal. There have been calls for Prime Minister Theresa May to resign.
Brexit is in question.
I was just going to say, this has big repercussions on Brexit. In other words, it's a hot mess. And we here in the United States are happy that we're not the only hot mess going on in the civilized world. Nationally, obviously, there was the much-anticipated testimony of former FBI Director James Comey. I, for one, thought it was going to be a dud, but I found myself watching. It was riveting.
It was riveting. I watched the entire thing.
Then locally, we have things. We had the budget shortfall and anticipated cuts stories. We had two big trials. The teenager, Michelle Carter, is on trial as a test of whether someone who goads another to commit suicide can be convicted of manslaughter. Of course, the Michael McCarthy trial for the murder of Bella Bond. There's all sorts of issues going on at the legislature, the sanctuary state bill. It was pretty interesting, but nothing about nature, huh?
Nothing about nature. There are mosquitoes. There are ticks carrying all kinds of disease. There are black widow spiders. Also, the UV index is hugely high, so we want you to come out and enjoy the weather. So basically, what we're saying is, slather yourselves in DEET and sunscreen, and come out and enjoy the weather. It is true. Life is coming at all of us really, really fast. So what we want to do is slow it down and have somebody here to help us through it. So Harvey Silverglade is here to talk about what James Comey's testimony means for the Trump presidency. We're going to talk about First Amendment on campus, which is a very huge issue. And it says something about a free and unfettered press and the future of that as well. In America. So Harvey Silverglade, who I'm sure many of you know, is the author of Three Felonies a Day, How the Feds Target the Innocent, and he's the co-author of The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses. This is right in his wheelhouse. So Harvey, welcome to our first show. We're so happy to have you.
Well, it's good to be here on the inauguration of this experiment.
Thank you so much. So let's dive right in. Give us your takeaway from Comey's testimony this past week, and is there an obstruction of justice case to be made against Trump?
Okay, I am fascinated by the debate over whether there is an obstruction of justice case, because to me it seems so clear that there is not. Now, I have to say, I think Trump is a disaster for the country. I did not vote for him. and he's, in my view, clearly unfit to be in the White House, and I think he has sociopathic tendencies that are very worrisome. Despite my views as a lawyer, I have to say that he has not committed obstruction of justice or any other crime. And I am fascinated by the fact that the press has been gobbling up the testimony of Comey. This is the first time in my adulthood, and I'm 75, I've been an adult for a while, that the press is actually in love with somebody from the FBI. I didn't think I would live to see
the day. Well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right.
Well, it's quite a friend, though, the FBI. I actually think the FBI has the same institutional problems now that it had when J. Edgar Hoover was in charge. Nothing much has changed except that they're now going after somebody that the press doesn't like. Mm. So there's an awful lot of intellectual dishonesty, and we have to step back and try to take a more objective view of what's going on with Trump.
Well, so let me ask you how you then, given that your conclusion on this, how you then interpret both the statute, which requires just someone endeavoring to interfere or influence with an ongoing federal investigation, which in this case, the evidence of which would have to be evidence of threat and evidence of corrupt intent. And the argument that's being made here is that the evidence of threat is that Comey's job was essentially being threatened by Trump, and the evidence of corrupt intent was the removal of everybody from the room and saying it to him privately on the heels of having him or asking him to swear a loyalty oath. And I'm doing this assuming that Comey's testimony, which is under oath versus anything that Trump has said, is accurate. How do you interpret that as not being an obstruction case, given how broadly that case could be approached?
Let's assume that Comey is accurate, and I suspect he probably was accurately recounting the conversation or conversations with the president. I think that we have forgotten that the president can remove the director of the FBI for any reason the president wants. That is not an obstruction of justice. It's an exercise of political power endowed by the Constitution on the president's incredibly powerful position. And I think that we lose track of what the real meaning of what's going on by trying to interpret this as a criminal act by the president. I think it was a political act by the president. And as a political act, it's as worrisome as any criminal act could possibly be. But let's not fool ourselves into thinking there's an easy solution, you know, prosecute the guy. He can't be prosecuted. He's the president of the United States. He's immune from prosecution for this. Well, then, what's left? Impeach the guy. Okay, that's a political act. Mm-hmm. You don't have to commit a crime in order to be impeached. And I think that would be terrific, except for one thing. You're not going to get a majority of the House or the Senate to go along with an impeachment. And so we're stuck with trying to report accurately, which the news media has not been doing, in my view, accurately and dispassionately what's going on. So when we get to the position where we can do something about it, it's called an election. We'll have one in 3 years. Hopefully this guy who has his finger on the nuclear trigger will not destroy the world in the 3 years. We'll still be around. And we can elect somebody who deserves to be in the White House. And that's neither Trump nor Hillary Clinton, I should say.
Why do you
think... Don't get me started. we'll have to do a second show about
that's
that.
That's a whole different show. Why do you think the news media, in your view, is being so dishonest in covering this?
Because they are become so partisan in this hyper-partisan world that we're in. The news media got sucked into the same left-right food fight. Mm. It's a food fight, for God's sake, that everybody else has been in. And I like to think that there are two groups of people who can exercise the discipline to keep out of this food fight. The judges, it's obvious why they shouldn't be in the food fight. And the journalists, to me, it's obvious why they shouldn't be in, but they're deeply in it, right up to their necks.
Well, let me ask you this then. How do you state the president's power to fire the FBI director or to direct whether or not any investigation should go forward or should cease as an absolute power of the president? U.S. v. Nixon actually says it's not absolute. It's actually no more absolute than any of the other rights that inure to individuals.
Nixon instructed people to lie and obstructed justice. The thing about Trump is he can fire Comey for any reason he wants. He can also suggest to Comey that he go easy on this one and go harder on that one. That he can do.
Oh, no, he could fire Comey for any reason, but admitting that he fired Comey in order to get the pressure off, which is what he not only admitted in person to the Russian foreign...
But he's allowed to do that. That might be grounds for impeachment. It is not a grounds for prosecution,
but
certainly.
If you're talking... My point is that if you're talking about corrupt intent, right, you're right. It may be grounds for impeachment. I think that there's... Here's what I think is. I think that there's a prima facie case
what
for
you're
obstruction
calling
that
corrupt,
needs more evidence.
What you're calling corrupt is just as easy to call it a political intent.
But you can have a corrupt political intent.
Well, I'm not sure that that's quite true. You can have a... You can engage in a crime for political reasons, if that's what you're saying. But there's a difference when the president is acting within the presidential powers. You can't say that that's a crime. If he were to say to Comey, you should lie, you should falsify reports, that is criminal. But for the president to say, go easy on the people who are in my camp. That is not a crime.
How is that not an issue of fact, though? An issue of fact for a fact finder to decide that when someone of the president's stature says, I hope you will let him go.
Because he's allowed to say that.
That is the same thing.
He's allowed to say that. And that's you know, we're all looking at this as if there's something criminal, the president expressing his desires to his...
Or corrupt. A corrupt intent.
Well, it's certainly partisan, but I don't think it's...
You're saying it's vague enough that it doesn't meet that criteria. If you're just tuning in, this is Boston Public Radio Weekend. We're live here at the WGBH studios at the Boston Public Library, and we're talking to civil liberties and criminal defense attorney Harvey Silbergrate. How about if we just switch gears for a moment and we talk about one of your, obviously, specialties, which is something that you've been working on for years, freedom of speech, and, you know, an issue that has been taking pretty much all the headlines recently, freedom of speech in campus. So, you know, one question that I had that perhaps is simplistic or I hope not, where do you personally draw the line between hate speech and free speech?
Hate speech is free speech. I don't draw any line. And I should point out the Supreme Court opinions. There are quite a few Supreme Court opinions about hate speech, and they have been decided unanimously, including the liberals and the conservatives, that hate speech is protected by the First Amendment. It's not a close question. And on campuses, which should be the freest places in our society, in fact, that is where the legitimacy of hate speech is questioned the most intensely. The way I like to put it, I live in Cambridge. I do a lot of cases for Harvard students. Things that you can say in Harvard Square, you get in trouble for saying in Harvard Yard. It should be the reverse.
Now, this is people think of this as a relatively new thing. There certainly is probably a level of fervor that may or may not be tied to the current occupants of the White House and sort of a prevalence, but you've been doing this since the late 60s, 1967. This is not new.
This is not new. There's a new intensity right now to the lack of respect for free speech, intellectual freedom on campuses. A new intensity, and that I think is triggered by the occupant of the White House and how controversial he is. However, the notion that college administrators tried to tamp down students' free speech rights and that students tried to censor each other, that is not new, but there's a new virulence to it that's very worrisome.
There was a piece in The New Yorker on June 4th by Jean Suk Gerson, and it really went directly to this issue. It's entitled, actually, How Trump Has Stoked the Campus Debate on Speech and Violence. And it really gets to the influence that the White House has had on speech generally in the country, but most particularly in our institutions of higher learning, but also makes two other sort of very important points, that students on campuses today, and this may be new, I think it is new, are defining the actual speech itself as violence that then provokes this sort of violent response.
Outcome, right.
Right, to make sure that violence is, that they feel is being done to them, they're defending themselves. That's kind of how they're seeing it. And the other point that it makes is there's this bureaucratic response to what is, in fact, a very visceral issue. So can you speak to those two things?
Yes. Professor Suk Gerson is very, very acutely aware of what's going on. She's a very smart observer. I happen to know her. And she really does understand what's happening. The speech as violence notion, it's of course absurd when you take a step back. Speech is the opposite of violence. People who are angry, there are two things they could do. They could speak about it, or they can engage in violence. Those are mutually separate, opposite, actually, concepts. And the problem is, on the college campuses, that a lot of activists, and aided by college administrators, who really don't understand academic values. That's the problem. You know, there are more college administrators now than professors in American higher education. It's been a terrible shift in the last 5 or 6 years. It preceded Trump. They don't understand the vast difference between speech and violence. And so they are outlawing speech that is very provocative and unpopular on the ground that it's somehow violence. They really need an educational seminar, these administrators.
So we've seen a lot of instances in which universities and colleges have revoked invitations for controversial speakers.
Ann Coulter.
Yeah. And we have many, many examples. But your foundation, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which you co-founded, you guys keep a database of attempts to disinvite campus speakers since 2000. I believe there's more than 300 attempts have been recorded, right? What I found fascinating is the political aspect of this, that about three-quarters of the attempts involved pressure from liberals. Of course, a quarter, you know...
From progressives.
From progressives.
Yeah.
And a quarter came from the right.
Yeah, liberals, I should point out, liberals tend to be civil libertarians. Progressives tend to not be civil libertarians. Same thing on the right, by the way. There's the civil libertarian right, and then there is the authoritarian right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there are really four groups we're talking about
okay.
here.
But overwhelmingly,
right
progressives
now,
right now are
right
more
now,
interested the, in...
Right.
Why so do you think that is?
Well, I want to point out that when I started my career back mm-hmm. in the late 60s, it was mainly the campus censorship was coming from the right. Mm-hmm. You know, the shoe changes from one foot to the other, but the result is really the same. So mm-hmm. right now, mm-hmm. it's the progressives who are trying to censor. And I think it's happening because they think that if they can shut up the other side, they can win the political war. But, you know, history shows that that isn't true at all. It simply aggravates the situation. And if people are not allowed to speak freely, then that's when violence really can erupt because people are frustrated. It's a very bad development in higher education.
I don't disagree about your points on free speech and how unfettered it should be at all. But I do think that there is genuine fear across the country, and of course it's going to leach into our colleges and universities, about the acceptance of hate speech at the highest levels and people feeling the need to do something as an individual, because you're not going to get any sort of role modeling or anything from the top saying this is not acceptable in this country, and people feeling as though they have to take it upon themselves to make that point.
I have a very simple answer to the question, and I learned the answer listening to a speech by a student at the University of Wisconsin who has made a speech trying to talk the faculty out of adopting a faculty hate speech code. And the student got up, he was a senior, and he said, look, I'm a senior, I'm about to graduate, and I'm looking out in the world. He said, I'm a gay student. The student admitted that sexual orientation back at a time when it wasn't so easy to admit. And he said, I'm going to go out in the world, and I want to know whom I can turn my back on and whom I can't. And without free speech, that's impossible. Because unless the bigots are allowed to espouse their bigotry, I don't know whom to trust. I thought that that was the wisest, powerful justification for free speech I'd ever heard. And he won the day. The faculty pivoted around and voted down the speech code. It was a transformative experience.
Well,
one of the other things that your database, I think, points up is that left to their, and this goes to your point about bureaucrats or administrators outnumbering actual educators mm-hmm. In colleges and universities, left to their own devices, students tend to figure this out on their own.
They are wonderful. I adore students, as you can tell. I
yes.
don't like administrators, academic administrators.
I hadn't noticed.
So you think the university should not play a role then in?
That's correct. When I was.
But what happens when violence does happen then? Because there's a clear affirmative obligation on behalf of a college or university to respond to it and to act not just with. To do something remedial, to do something that prevents it from happening again.
Well, you know, when you have a speech, students are attending a speech, and the university has 18 members of the campus police force show up, you already establish an atmosphere where people are expecting violence. Mm. When I was an undergraduate, I was in the class of 64 at Princeton. We had no campus policemen. We had three plainclothes people who walked around mainly to make sure the students kept the dormitory rooms clean and orderly. And there was one dean of students, and we had no riots. And I think, and I don't think human nature has changed since the 60s. What's changed is that university administrations are expecting and communicate that they're expecting trouble. And when you communicate that, you can tend to have trouble. And I think there's a terrible atmosphere right now on the campuses, and that we should really stop and take a look at what we're doing. If I hear that some college to which I donate money has hired one more 13th deputy assistant to the dean of inclusion, I will have the check stopped. I'll call my bank.
Andrea, you were saying earlier why or how this is. This is exactly why college costs so much, because they are required to maintain this bureaucracy that just costs millions and millions.
Right, it's administrators and the purchase of land. Those are the two things that I think really most tuition amounts are going for.
But you see, when you have so many administrators, they need something to do. And that is where the trouble comes in.
Right, right.
They make themselves situations that they can then intervene in.
They find things to
do. Well, you have to justify. Right, you have to justify your job. Right,
right, right. So, one issue that has become a little controversial, maybe not so much for you, Harvey, but you know, there are people whom the president has been blocking on Twitter, and these persons are now trying to make the case legally that they have the right to have access to the president, and so that is that. Blocking their First Amendment rights?
That is a very subtle and difficult question. Mm. I tend to come down on the side of saying that the president cannot block, because that Twitter account is really done in his capacity as president, not a private citizen.
His press spokesperson admitted that. So John Spicer said these are the president's official statements.
I tend to come down on this. Professor Eugene Volokh of the UCLA Law School, who's one of the leading First Amendment scholars in the country, has analyzed this on his Volokh conspiracy, which is carried by the Washington Post website. And I think Professor Volokh is right about that. I think Trump is wrong. If somebody goes to court, they'll probably beat them.
But let me ask you this. Do you see it as a free speech issue or a public records issue? Because when I first read this, that's what I thought.
Public record.
Is that this is a matter of public
record. I see it as
and
both,
the public
actually.
Should have a right of access.
I see it as both. This is a president who doesn't really like free speech. Mind you, he's not alone. There are a lot of presidents who loved it until they got into the White House.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Well, then you start hearing from the people who disagree with you, which is exactly what is happening on his Twitter account.
And this is not a guy who likes criticism. Mind you, we haven't had a president who likes criticism in an awfully long time, perhaps ever. But that's different from trying to shut down speech. And the president, I think, has gone overboard here, and I think that that's not going to survive.
Let me ask you this. Can you give us your thoughts on this upcoming week's... Attorney General Jeff Sessions has agreed to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee.
He's sending a deputy to the Appropriations Committee to talk
this
about
is behind
the budget.
Doors. Yeah. Can you give us a sense of what to expect there? What are your thoughts on Sessions and his testimony?
Well, Sessions, poor Jeff Sessions, is so over his
Jefferson
head.
Jefferson Beauregard
Jefferson
Sessions
Beauregard.
The third.
He is so over his head in this position. I actually almost feel sorry for him.
Almost.
And you know... you know, the truth is that Trump is over his head as well. There are quite a few of them over their heads.
Pretty much everyone in that administration.
Right.
And I think it's going to be a comedy of errors. I don't think he's going to be answering the questions too well, because I don't think he's going to understand the questions too well. I don't think he understands his own obligations. This was not a good appointment. There are other people in the administration who are smarter and who are better defended. Not him.
No, I know you absolutely don't like to make predictions in this regard, but we've got about a minute left, so I want to do this sort of quick and dirty. Whether or not you think the Supreme Court of the United States will grant certiorari to the Trump administration and take their appeal on the Muslim ban. And certiorari, for people who don't know, is the Supreme Court gets to choose what cases
Correct.
It takes.
Yeah.
And it can turn you down and it can go and go
send
with the lower court opinion and send it back. Gorsuch is now on the court. Where do you think this falls?
I think the court will grant certiorari. And the main reason is that you've got courts of appeals that differ from one another. And it's a very high-profile, highly controversial program we're dealing with here. And I think the court will. Mm. I think that Trump will lose probably 5-4.
That's Harvey's prediction,
that,
right
that
here.
Is you my
hear,
prediction.
I think you're right.
You so much
thank
for joining
you.
Us.
You have to come back.
Absolutely. Harvey Silverglade is a civil liberties and criminal defense lawyer and a prolific author of books, articles, and columns on individual civil rights. You can find him at harveysilverglade.com or follow him on Twitter at @HASilverglade. Thank you so much. And up next, stay with us. How does a former Eagle Scout with a master's degree go from being an online bookseller to creating the Amazon of the dark web to life in prison? Find out. He's next on BPR Weekend, 89.7 WGBH. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio Weekend. This is Marcela Garcia, and she is
Andrea Cabral.
And we are live from the Boston Public Library. And I'm really excited about our next guest because we all shop online, right, Andrea?
I'm shopping online right now.
Okay.
I probably bought about $300 worth of stuff
already,
since we've been
and you
sitting
didn't even
in.
Know. Yeah. Well, in 2011, a 26-year-old man named Russ Ulbricht launched a website called The Silk Road on the Dark Web, which
I don't shop on the dark web. I will say that. I've never purchased
thank you for clarifying.
Anything through the dark web, although it's possible I will do it later on today.
So the Silk Road really started as an anonymous drug marketplace and quickly turned into the Amazon of the dark web, selling guns, fake IDs, counterfeit money, and even human organs. So on the line, we have Nick Bilton. He is a correspondent for Vanity Fair, a former columnist for the New York Times, and the author of a new book about precisely Russ Ulbricht called American Kingpin. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome, Nick. It's good to have you on. So first things first, how did you find out about Russ Ulbricht and the Silk Road, and what made you ultimately write more than an article but a whole book about it?
As you just said, I'm a former columnist for the New York Times, and I used to cover technology and culture and business and hackers, you name it. And I lived in San Francisco in this area called Glen Park, and near my house was this tiny little public library. I mean, it was the size of a shoe store, and I used to walk by that shoe store that library every day with my dog. And it turned out the guy who was the most wanted man on the entire internet, who Russ Ulbricht, who was running the Silk Road, was caught there running the site with tens of millions of dollars on his laptop in Bitcoin, which is a digital currency, and what they believed was several murders under his belt.
So he's in jail, serving a life sentence, obviously because of his role in creating this marketplace where crimes were being committed. People were killed due to the drugs they were buying. Many people have thought that his sentencing was a little too harsh compared to other people involved in the case. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question that I get a lot, and it's one of the criticisms of people who are big supporters of Ross, and there are a lot of them out there. They think that he ran a website where drugs and guns and things like that were for sale, but that he himself wasn't selling most of them. He did sell mushrooms in the beginning. He grew his own magic mushrooms to sell on the site, which was how the site actually developed. And this is a big part of the beginning of the book in American Kingpin, where he grows his own mushrooms in this secret laboratory, and it's quite dramatic. He's actually watching Breaking Bad while he's doing it, which is kind of ironic. But he, you know, there are beliefs that he shouldn't have gotten two life sentences. And there are two arguments to it, one against and one for. The argument for it is, if you go look in jails today, in federal prisons, there are people from the Bronx and so on who sold drugs on the street who got life sentences.
Absolutely.
And so
true.
just because he was a white kid behind a computer doesn't mean that he shouldn't get those same sentences. Of course, the argument against is the fact that he was just running a website, but it was a website that had a massive impact on society. There was a story in the New York Times just today about how one of the biggest rises in fentanyl, which is part of the heroin epidemic, is coming through the dark web, and the Silk Road was the founding of that. There have been numerous reports showing this similar things. You know, he tried to have people killed, even though they weren't actually killed. And so that is another part of what led to the life sentence, too. So I can see both sides of it.
He really did become a kingpin. But I think one of the most fascinating things about this story, and I've read your book, and by the way, there is some exquisite prose in that book, referring to him as a fungi culturists when he was growing shrooms.
Fungiculturists.
Yeah. I'd never seen the word before. It's one of many delights when you're reading the book that you see. But what was so interesting about him is that he encompasses this sort of staggering level of naivety and arrogance. So he has these libertarian views. He's very heavily influenced by libertarian writings. He was part, when he was at UPenn, he was part of a libertarian, also in Texas, I believe, when he was in school, was part of a libertarian group. And he really felt like, you know, whatever people want to put into their bodies or buy or any of those things should be up to them. And you look at him, in other ways, he was sort of a genius. I mean, he really was a very, very smart guy. He seems to be genuinely surprised that this all worked out this way. And yet this was a person who was facilitating guns, fake IDs, all kinds of information,
and making
to
money
hack computers, and making a huge right. amount of money. Where do you see where he crossed the line from this sort of pure libertarian, I'm doing this to change the system, into, hey, you know what, I could be a billionaire by the time I'm 30.
I think that the thing is that he kind of encompasses most of the CEOs that I encountered in Silicon Valley covering it for over a decade. You know, the CEO of Uber, for example, Travis Kalanick, has been under tremendous fire for the way he's run his company unethically, with all these different things, all these issues at play. And he is the same person. He, you know, he has these libertarian viewpoints and quotes the same Ayn Rand novels and things like that. And Ross Ulbricht was just another version of that. What the problem is, and I truly do believe this, Ross's downfall wasn't the drugs, the guns, the fake murders, the tens of millions of dollars he made from all these things, or even the overdoses. It was hubris. He believed that he was smarter than everyone else, that he was going to get away, and there was, even if he did get caught, that nothing would ever come back to him. And he just kept pushing and pushing and pushing until the point that he, you know, ended up where he is. I mean, there's one perfect example of the story in the book where he orders some fake IDs in case he needs to flee the country, and he orders them from the Silk Road, and they end up getting, just by chance, getting intercepted at the San Francisco mail facility, and the Department of Homeland Security comes to his house. They have no idea that he's running the Silk Road, and they say to him, you know, we're not here to arrest you. We just want to know where you got these IDs and how we could get them if we want to.
oh my God!
And they ask that simply because they are investigators looking into how fake IDs are sold on the internet and so on. So Ross just arrogantly responds, well, hypothetically, someone could get them on the Silk Road, where you could get guns and drugs too.
So he's self-promoting.
Yeah.
So he's self-promoting his site. He's self-promoting his site to two detectives standing on his front porch. Who does that?
Somebody, you know, who watches a lot of Breaking Bad, and well, I think that
exactly.
really was an influence.
Yeah.
About no, that, do you think that was an influence? You know, to what extent did that, you know, mirror his real life?
No. I don't think it was an influence because he didn't start watching, from my reporting that I've done, he didn't start watching the show until he actually started growing the mushrooms. I mean, maybe there was some influence. But I really truly think the influence was the libertarian culture that he became enamored with at Penn State. And, you know, he was the kid that we all went to school with who had this idea that the government was too big and overreaching and did bad things. And that person usually ends up, you know, getting a job, getting married, living happily ever after, or even going and working for the government to try to fix it. And Ross decided he was going to take a different approach, which on one hand is admirable, but the way that he went about it with this no holds barred, anything I do is not my – anything that happens as a result of this is not my fault. I think that was the thing that ended up leading to his downfall.
But he's also this multidimensional guy. So like most of us, he dwells or seems to dwell a great deal on what he felt up to that point were his successive failures at things. So there's this idea that I ought to be better or more famous or more successful at this point in my life, and I haven't been. Things I've been doing haven't been working out. And that kind of, that along with, I think, the Ayn Rand philosophy, I think is part of the arrogance. What's your take on that?
You're completely right. I mean, I think part of the problem today is that we live in a culture of fame, where everyone wants to be famous. I have a podcast for Vanity Fair called Inside the Hive, and I recently interviewed Conan O'Brien, and we were talking about fame, and he was saying how we live in this culture where people used to come up to him and they'd say, oh, I would love to be on your show when I'm older for being a musician or a basketball player or whatever. And he said, now they just come up and they say, I want to be on your show.
Right.
And they have, right. And they just want to be famous for being famous. And people want to be remembered for something in the society we live in today, whether it's like the Kardashians just for being famous,
right.
Or
exactly.
Whatever it is.
Exactly.
And Ross took that approach with having an impact on society. And he truly did start this with altruistic goals. He believed that the system was broken, that people end up going to jail for buying and selling drugs or doing drugs, and wanted to prove that if you made a marketplace where everything was legal, that the world would be safer as a result. The problem was, he ended up connecting people to drugs that they never would have been able to get their hands on, and kids died as a result of it, along with all these other things that took place too.
Well, that's one of the things that I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned the New York Times article earlier, and by the way, we're talking to Nick Bilton, author of American Kingpin, a book about Russ Albrecht. So underground drug markets are alive and thriving. There was this case that I was... It was really sad. Last fall, two 13-year-olds died in Park City, Utah, after consuming some drug that they called Pinky, a powerful synthetic opioid. God knows what that was. But, you know, despite arrests, despite everything that law enforcement is doing, these merchants are quickly emerging. So...
Yeah, what happened was that I didn't know when I first started reporting the book, but I discovered as I continued to report it. And I, you know, just to back up for one second, I ended up getting access to millions of words of chat logs and diary entries from Ross. I spent hundreds of hours with law enforcement. I visited the places where the drugs are discovered. I even met the dogs that find some of the drugs. And I learned along the way that that there was a two-pronged thing that happened because of the Silk Road. Ross's goal was actually realized. It did prove that by figuring out a way to legally buy drugs, that people felt safer buying online, that violence did slow down a little bit. The negative result of it was that kids that never would have been able to get access, and not just kids, adults too, never would have been able to get access to these labs in China where there's no regulation, where they make completely synthetic drugs that are 50 to 100 times stronger than traditional heroin here, we're able to do that. And you have these overdoses. And the final point to this is the way people access the dark web where all these drugs and things are sold is through a browser called Tor. It's like a web browser.
I was just going to ask you to explain to people how they could hide behind this curtain.
So Tor was originally developed by the United States government to allow people in the Navy or Army that were overseas while they were serving the government to be able to log on to Tor and communicate with their family back home in America without the government of the country they were in snooping on what they were doing. And so it is completely 1,000% anonymous. The guys who started it, the group who started it, they came out a couple of weeks ago and said that they are completely dismayed with what has happened with the dark web because of the Silk Road. Now 95% of it is not used for good purposes, but is used to buy and sell drugs and guns and things like that. And that you have this influx of these synthetic opioids that are coming into the United States, helping to lead to the opioid epidemic as a result of those websites.
And I actually thought that was one of the more important points that your book made, was that, you know, especially in terms of cyber and in this dark web, building a better mousetrap is the coin of the realm. And so not only was Ross Ulbricht selling the mechanisms to hack into systems and malware and all of these, they under the category called services that they provided, you could literally find out how to get access to all of this stuff. The competition is huge. Every time law enforcement figures out how to find you, someone's going to build a better mousetrap and figure out how to hide better.
You're completely right, and I think that the thing that's been so difficult, I think, for law enforcement with the fentanyl stuff. And I mean, look, for me, buying and selling mild drugs, marijuana, you know, magic mushrooms, things like that, I actually do agree with Ross. There's been literally no recorded cases of people overdosing and dying from these things. You know, and I do agree that people shouldn't go to jail for that. It should be treated like alcohol, whatever. But when it comes to heroin and crack and things like that, those aren't drugs; they're poisons. And I don't. My personal belief is that they should not be legal in any way, shape, or form. And the problem with the synthetic versions of these, it's much harder to get those in bulk into the country from China. It's incredibly easy to just drop them in the mail and mail them to someone in the U.S. like those two 13-year-old kids that you mentioned.
So real quickly, we have only a minute left, but I know that you wrote this book without talking to Ross. He didn't agree to be interviewed. Can you explain how you did that?
Yeah, so Ross lived his life very privately in public. He only told two people that he had run the site and started the site, an ex-girlfriend and a friend from college. But when he was online running the website from coffee shops and libraries all around the world, he had a dozen employees working for him, and everything was kept in chat formats and diary entries and photos and things like that. And so I was able to get access to those things that were captured in his investigation. And it ended up being about 3 million words of stuff. And we took that and his social media feeds where he was being Ross, and we put those together in a database. And it was essentially better than spending 1,000 hours interviewing him, because it was 3 years of all that content. And I was able to create a narrative nonfiction book based on it.
Wow.
Well, as we also know, his appeal to get a new trial was just denied on May 31st of this year. So,
yep.
Nick, the book is fantastic for everyone out there. This is a great read. It's fascinating on a number of levels, and as I said, the prose is delightful. Thank you so much for being with us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me.
Nick Bilton is a special correspondent for Vanity Fair, a contributor on CNBC, and the author of American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. Follow him on Twitter at Nick Bilton. Nick, thanks so much for joining us. And up next, we'll take a look at the week ahead. This is Boston Public Radio Weekend, 89.7 WGBH. Welcome back to BPR Weekend. Before we go, we're going to look ahead to the coming week. Marcella, what do you have your eye on?
Oh, boy. So, number one, last Friday, we learned that the state's bond rating was downgraded despite solid economic growth in the Bay State. So all eyes on the governor.
That's a big deal.
It's a huge deal. This is the first time it happens in 30 years. And the Baker administration is saying, you know what, this doesn't really mean much because, you know, it may not cost us more to borrow, but, you know, that's still an upper question.
A downgraded rating, right. And isn't it based on infrastructure and the fact that we've done little over the years to repair our crumbling roads and bridges?
It's also based on the fact that we've been raiding the rainy day
fund, right.
And this is, you know, to be fair, this is not just on Governor Baker. It's also on the legislature. So there's going to be a lot to be said about that this week. There's also, I'm looking forward to Thursday, there's a press conference in which Latino leaders here in the greater Boston area will release an updated report on the underrepresentation of Latinos in government in Boston and Chelsea. And this report is titled The Silent Crisis Part 2. It comes at the heels of a Boston Foundation report released last week that also underscored the importance of Latinos to the economic future of Boston. Did you know, Andrea, that 1 in 5 Bostonians is Latino?
No, I actually did not know that.
A lot of people don't know that. And so that's, I think that is one of the key things that institutions are not trying, and frankly, the government as well, the city government is trying to come up with real strategies to close these gaps. And so I'm looking forward to that on Thursday. Of course, Attorney General Sessions, his testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, God knows what is going to come out of that. For next weekend, the tall ships return. I'm really looking forward to that. So that's pretty much it.
All right. And as always, keep your eye on Washington, D.C., and also keep an eye out for your health care and the Senate bill that's going to get rammed through pretty quickly. And before I forget, I want to shout out to Pride Week. It's the last day of Pride Week, and there's a block party happening right now in the Back Bay. And at 1:30 here at the BPL's DeFerrari Hall, there's going to be a Pride Arts performance of a reimagining of Shakespeare's As You Like It that's called And All the Men and Women Merely Players. Please come down, celebrate, and enjoy this beautiful weather. That is all for us, our first show of BP, our weekend. We broadcast live on Sundays from noon to 1 from the GBH studios. I'm Andrea Cabral. You can follow me on Twitter at Critical Thought. Tomorrow on BPR, Jim and Marjorie talk to Obama's former drug czar, Michael Botticelli. How are you feeling, Marcella?
Great.
We got through it. We did it.
Right,
Let's fist bump. We should fist bump.
Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. I'm Marcella Garcia. Follow me on Twitter at Marcella_Elisa. If you'd like to weigh in on BPR weekend, we would love to hear from you. Send emails to bpr@wgbh.org. Thanks to our producers, Jason Tereske, Christina Bean, and Chelsea Merce. Thank you so much. Until next Sunday.
Be nice to each other. Save the Republic.
That's right.
Oh, we forgot John Parker. John Parker's our engineer. We love him. He's the Claw.